You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Few aphorisms that have been compiled by our guest today, Dr. Robert Fuller. A good answer may change a mind, but a good question can change a world. Let your questions ripen into quests. What do you take pains over? The answer is a clue to what you have to contribute. To arrive is good, to embark is better. The person who completes a quest is not the one who set forth. Each of these statements I just read invite me, and I imagine you, dear listener, to pause and ponder their meaning to our own lives. And today, this is what we'll be exploring with our guest, Dr. Robert Fuller. Robert Fuller is a physicist and former president of Oberlin College. He has consulted with Indira Gandhi, met with Jimmy Carter regarding the President's Commission on World Hunger, and worked to defuse the Cold War in Russia when it was known as the USSR. As Fuller reflected on his career, he realized that he has been, at different times in his life, a somebody and a nobody. His periodic sojourns into nobody land led him to identify rankism, the abuse of power inherent in rank, and ultimately write the book Somebodies and Nobodies, Overcoming the Abuse of Rank. He has become a recognized leader of the dignity movement to overcome rankism and keynoted a Dignity for All conference hosted by the president of Bangladesh. His many other accomplishments include co-authoring the textbook Mathematics of Classical Quantum Physics, as well as the book Somebodies and Nobodies, also Dignity for All, Religion and Science, A Beautiful Friendship, the novel The Rowan Tree, a children's book co-authored by his wife Claire Sheridan, Theo the White Squirrel, The Theory of Everybody, and Questions and Quests, a short book of aphorisms. Join us for the next hour as we explore the art of asking better questions with our guest, Dr. Robert Fuller. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Bob, I want to welcome you to the New Dimensions once more.
Thank you, Justine.
We've been sitting together, both myself and with my former partner, Michael Toms, for many decades now, really discussing and looking at and delving into what are the questions we should be asking. I think that this is why this book just really popped out at me, because it's a small book, but it's posing questions. And I think of all the attributes that you bring and experience that you bring are the questions that you have brought forth throughout all the decades of your exploration. So Let's talk about the importance of the questions we're asking. Just, do you have a comment on that?
Yes. I think people tend to overlook their questions, and in doing so, they're really overlooking a gold mine, because if you don't suppress your question just because you don't have an answer, and let it into your life and into your mind and heart, it will eventually produce an answer. It may take 50 years, or may only take 5 or 5 days, but getting the question posed, I mean, put it this way, until something is posed as a question, your attempts to deal with that underlying problem are murky. Once you've got it in a form of a question, it almost guarantees you will find an answer. The biggest problem is not getting the answer, it's formulating something that's answerable. And that's a good question. I think of I.I. Robbie. The name may not be as familiar as the name Einstein, but it's almost that familiar to physicists. I.I. Robbie was a professor at Columbia, where I was a young professor. And he was the first physicist to get the Nobel Prize after World War II. And he got it for developing radar, which played a huge role in winning World War II. And Robbie said once that when he would come home from school, his mother wouldn't say, "Did you have a good day at school?" She would say, rather, "Did you ask a good question today, Izzy?" That was his nickname, Izzy. "Izzy, did you ask a good question today?" I thought, what a wonderful parent to tune their children into the power and the clarity that results from asking a good question.
I'm reminded, I just ran across a quote about the way our mind works. And it was a quote by an Israeli psychologist, and I don't recall his name, but he said that when we look at what we believe or what we know, or when we're looking at questions or reality, when we look at reality, reality is actually a cloud of possibility. But our mind goes to wanting reality to be a single point. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we just go into that, what you just said, it supports what we believe then, and then mm-hmm. we create that as our reality or as a reality.
And we ignore that field of possibilities that surround the one choice. And it's just like quantum theory, by the way. That's the whole essence of a quantum understanding of the world is you look at all the possible ways things could organize themselves. And then when you take a measurement, you collapse all those possibilities into a single thing. So that going to and fro between a field of possibilities and singling one out is the process of quantum measurement. So it's interesting that the same kind of structure exists, as you've just described it, that was discovered only in the 20th century as the nature of reality.
Well, that just opens up so much. As human beings, we like to nail it down.
Yeah.
We want to know the truth. We want to have fences around it. We want to build edifices to it and say, "Whew, man, it's all figured out." And it's so hard for us to live in unknowingness or uncertainty.
Well, you have to go back and forth. You need some answer, but you should think of it not as written in stone, but as heuristic, as something useful that'll get you to the next field of possibilities, which will contain a better answer. So an answer is like a springboard to another field of possibilities, and then you collapse that into a better answer. And we can't do without answers. We have to do something. We can't just live in that cloud. So we continually have to collapse it and expand it.
So we would be saying to ourselves, okay, this is my best guess for right now.
Yeah.
For right now. But it's up until now, so to speak. And then I'm taking a breath and, okay, that it might be more than this.
Yeah.
And in this era of great polarization, how can we help ourselves as a society to just sort of open up to that possibility of knowing that it's not set in stone?
Well, it really is a whole new way of looking at the world and a whole new methodology of proceeding. And alas, our leaders, very few of them are acquainted with that reality, with that way things actually are. The world doesn't think in a quantum way at all yet. Just a few people do, a small percentage. You do. People who are on your show tend to. That's what's attractive and unique about it. But the average person in the street and our representatives in Washington don't think that way, and it will be a long, slow process until they gradually do understand reality in this more plastic and flexible way where every answer is temporary. Einstein said it better than anyone ever has. He said he could hardly wait for his theories to be invalidated and go into the dustbin of history. He said that's the fate of every theory, no matter how good it is. Eventually, it's found to have a flaw. And in fixing that flaw, we come up with a better theory. But it, too, isn't the final answer.
You know, I don't know. You know where my head is going right now?
Where?
Just this odd sort of, maybe not so odd, but I'm just thinking we're just today, in the last couple of days, we've just come off of the election that happened for the governorship in Virginia and other places. And I'm noticing that of the different people that were elected to the local legislature in, let's say, Virginia, that most of them were women replacing older white men.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that?
Yes, and that's happening across the country, and it's going to change the nature of governance when I bet it settles out at 60-40 women to men rather than the current 20-80.
Somehow, I'm just thinking that possibly with the psyche of women,
yeah,
who are tending and befriending more or less, it's a tendency of,
yes,
the feminine psyche to tend and befriend, that then that might move us closer to what we're talking about in that quantum feel,
yeah,
of possibilities rather than going for that strict, this is the only solution.
I think so.
Well, we'll talk more about that in just one moment. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Robert W. Fuller, and he is the author of many books, including Questions and Quests, a short book on aphorisms, and The Theory of Everybody. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, robertworksfuller.com. Robert Works, W-O-R-K-S, Fuller.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Dr. Robert Fuller, and he is the author of many, many books, including Questions and Quests, a short book of aphorisms, and The Theory of Everybody. Bob, one of the aphorisms that you brought up in your wonderful little book, Questions and Quest, is that the redistribution of wealth is resisted more fiercely than the redistribution of recognition. What, can you elaborate on that? Why did that pop for you?
I suppose I noticed, like so many, that we actually kill off people to whom we give excessive recognition. I'm thinking of Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, Michael Jackson. They are like queen bees who are fed special honey, special royal jelly, and it turns the recipient grotesque. And that's what happened to our rock stars, and they get so much adulation, and they often live miserable personal lives. So I saw that there was a form of malrecognition, somewhat analogous to malnutrition, that can produce obesity. And the other side of that coin is that everyone needs recognition, just like everyone needs nutrition. You can't live without nutrition, your body dies, and you can't live without recognition, or your identity becomes warped and you do insane things like shoot up innocent people in a church to get recognition. So malrecognition is as dangerous as malnutrition, and recognition is as vital as nutrition, but it has to be in proper proportion. And I think human beings will prove capable of giving each other the recognition they actually deserve. We tend to worship rock stars excessively, as I just said, and we worship geniuses and so on, and everyone else is regarded as second rate compared to these people upon whom we heap so much recognition. But actually, I've noticed among the young especially that they're more aware of each other's contribution, and they're more willing to acknowledge the importance of other people in their lives. It's not so much a stand on your own two feet world. Young people especially are willing to accept help and ask for it and willing to grant recognition and give a round of applause to the people who prepared the food at a conference, not just the professors who are at the conference. I've noticed this, and I think as we begin to acknowledge each other's contribution, recognize each other's contribution, we, in effect, support people's dignity, because that's what people need to feel, that their dignity is healthy and intact. They need to feel they're contributing, and they need to be acknowledged for their contribution. So I see a field growing up in parallel to the field of nutrition, but this time focused on recognition. And as we get better at understanding the essential role played by other people in our own work, be it just supportive, like the guy who changes the oil in my car, or be it more directly related to my work in the sense of someone reads my stuff and says, I think you're wrong here. And in hashing that out, it improves it. We are, in fact, deeply, profoundly interdependent on one another. We're social animals. And our mutual recognition has lagged that understanding. It's going to catch up. And when it does, I think we're going to have a world in which paying one person 500 times what another worker gets is regarded as ridiculous, because you can't distribute money in a way that is contrary to the distribution of recognition. Recognition and money and salary ought to bear some relationship to each other. And as you understand the vital contribution everyone makes in a company, a good company, you begin to undermine the rationale of paying the boss 500 times what the secretary gets, or 300 times. The world is already onto this. There have rules in Scandinavian countries that no one shall be paid more than 10 times what the secretary is paid, what the lowest paid worker in the company is. In this country, it ranges up to 1,000 times what the lowest paid worker is. So I'm saying that's a really tough problem. You try to redistribute money and you won't get very far. First, let's redistribute recognition as we should have done, because it's not only the right thing to do, it's true. And then the redistribution of wealth and assets will follow.
So that takes us to your work in the dignitary movement and what that means, and rankism. And I know that your work has taken that, all the isms, like racism or homophobia or all of sexism, that it takes it, the underlying premise that is, that they're all based on is rankism.
They're all instances of rankism. They're all abuses of power predicated on the idea that one person or one group is superior to another group or person, that therefore they outrank them. That was the case in the days of segregation and Jim Crow, where all white people felt superior, inherently superior, to people with darker skin. And it's persists today in a milder form than it did 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but it still hasn't been eradicated, because underlying racism and sexism and all the isms is essentially a predatory relationship to each other. And I'm using that word a little differently. Of course, I don't mean that we prey on each other like lions and tigers do, but I mean that we are a predatory species, and you see this in the economic sphere. You see it in the social sphere, where one group will advantage itself relative to another group by claiming superiority and putting the second group down. That's rankism. And so long as we permit rankism in any form, we can't completely eradicate instances of it, of the, like racism and sexism. Those are both cases where whole groups of people regard themselves as inherently superior to other groups, and therefore they should get privileges. And they maintain that by denigration and by disrespect, and by actually enacting laws that make it harder for the people in the subordinated group to rise socially and rise economically.
Right. So I'm wondering about, like, all right, socially and economically, that is a reality in our present situation. I mean, but when we talk about, like, raising everybody up, then the people come in and say, oh, that's socialism. And here in the U.S., that's just a dirty word.
Yeah, except Bernie made it less so.
That's true.
He really made it less so. And so what is socialism? Socialism isn't anything specific. It's a greater awareness of the contribution of everyone to what it is a society produces. And accordingly, fairer compensation for everyone in that production. Socialism has a lot of fairness built into it. As an economic doctrine, it's flawed, just like capitalism is, and we will need some combination of the two to really thrive economically, because so far, the countries that have tried socialism and communism haven't done as well economically. So there's something valid about the capitalist process.
I was just thinking of communism like an extreme form of socialism.
Yeah.
Might have been might be described as communism, where it got off kilter, that it wasn't fair, even so much so that like the USSR just dissolved.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it violated all its own principles and essentially settled very quickly into a dictatorship, and so it wasn't a real example of communism as conceived by certain French and other political thinkers in the 19th century. And Marx and so on. I'm not touting any of those in their present form, but I do think capitalism is flawed, and I do think we can come up with a better combined system that preserves the independent initiative that characterizes capitalism. That's a good thing. That results in Silicon Valley. That results in the productivity-enhancing inventions that we're famous for. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we do want a fairer system. And as I was saying before, I think as we understand the validity of more equal recognition, we will infer properly that we ought to compensate people more equally and do away with these extreme differences, which are actually producing a bigger and bigger gap in wealth between the rich and the poor. So we really have no choice but to do something about it. If we don't, we will lose our democracy.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you see in young people today that there is a tendency for them to understand the interconnectedness of all of us, that we are holding each other up, whether we're a janitor or food server or a CEO of a tech company.
Exactly. Very, very well put. I see it in my own kids and grandchildren. They're just not as competitive in a nasty way as my generation was. Competition itself is okay. It helps you get the best out of yourself if you understand that it's not ultimately making one person superior to another, but it makes you superior to your former self. So a certain element of competitiveness is useful. But young people have taken the brutality out of competition, the sense that you're disgraced if you lose, the sense that winning is the only thing. All those old aphorisms are dead, really, are dying in the younger people of the world.
Well, I think we see this reflected, too, in at least here in the U.S., in our politics. It's either or. It's win or lose. It's and that's the whole game, not on the policies that might bring us all up together. At least that's my viewpoint.
Yeah.
That's what I'm seeing.
Well, those policies that might help raise everybody and reinvigorate the American dream, which is crucial. Without that, we're not America. If the American dream dies, America dies, in my opinion. So, and it has become less and less feasible to be sure to make sure that your children do better than you have. So that's going to be a crucial thing. And I think the young people are going to, as they come into maturity and come into positions of power, both in business and in government, I think they're going to demand more fairness.
I'm here with Dr. Robert Fuller. He's the author of Questions and Quests. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Robert Fuller, and he is the author.